Good afternoon and welcome to the November meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine. And a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. Since 1983, and we're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen, journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States, and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, Trita Parsi, whose topic is U.S.-Iran, is peace finally in the offering? Trita is an award-winning author and the founder and president of the National Iranian Council. His first book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, was written in 2007 and won the Silver Medal Award from the Council on Foreign Relations. His latest book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, was released early last year and was selected by Foreign Affairs as the best book of 2012 on the Middle East. Trita was born in Iran, but moved with his family at the age of four to Sweden in order to escape political repression in Iran. His father was an outspoken academic unusually for Iran, was not a Muslim. He was a Zoroastrianist. He was jailed by both the Shah and then by the Ayatollah. Trita moved to the United States as an adult and studied foreign policy at Johns Hopkins SAIS, where he received his doctorate, studying under Professor Francis Fukuyama. He's followed Middle East politics through work in the field and extensive experience on Capitol Hill and at the United Nations. He worked for the Swedish Permanent Mission to the UN, where he served with the Security Council. In addition to his doctorate from Johns Hopkins, he holds a master's degree in international relations from Uppsala University in Sweden, a master's degree in economics from the Stockholm School of Economics. He has served as an adjunct professor of international relations at SAIS, at the Middle East Institute, and as a policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. His articles on the Middle East have been published in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the LA Times, the Financial Times, the Jerusalem Post, and others. He's a frequent guest on CNN, PBS's NewsHour, the BBC, and Al Jazeera, and tomorrow night will be on the Stephen Colbert Show. So we're delighted to have Trita Parsi with us today.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a great, great pleasure being here. I know this must be a sophisticated group because the way you time these speaking engagements could not have been any better, mindful of what just happened in the last couple of days. I want to go in and talk a little bit about what happened in the last couple of days. But before that, I want to spend some time going over why is it that in the last couple of weeks, after 34 years, suddenly we've seen this amazing uptick in diplomacy and finally some positive prospects for a diplomatic deal. For so long, this enmity between the United States and Iran have plagued the entire Middle East and beyond. This enmity has created instability, and in every other conflict, the United States and Iran have usually ended up on the opposite side. And even if that specific conflict had nothing to do with it, it got even more difficult to resolve because of the differences between the U.S. and Iran. And there's been attempts at diplomacy. My books that are out there describe some of these events in great detail. And many times, both sides have been close. And I would say that, unfortunately, both sides have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. But never, never have we seen what's been going on in the last couple of weeks. With the new president in Iran and the president of the United States seeking a meeting with him at the UN, which didn't take place, but instead they had a 17-minute conversation over the phone, which was historic. The foreign minister of Iran and the United States met at the UN, had a half-hour bilateral meeting just between the two of them. And in the last couple of days, the Iranians and the Americans sat down with each other for about 18 hours a day. They couldn't get enough of each other after 34 years of estrangement. They spent more time talking to each other directly in the last couple of days than they have in the last past 34 years. Now the idea of the two sides talking to each other is no longer newsworthy. No journalist is going to write about it any longer because it's become normalized. That in and of itself is a major achievement. Now, why is this? Why is it that suddenly the two sides have shown so much greater courage and determination to pursue diplomacy than they have in the past, even when you consider the first year of the Obama administration, when he so famously, during his inaugural address, 12 minutes into his presidency, he reached out to Iran, saying that if the Iranians unclenched their fist, the United States will extend a hand. And there was strong determination by the president back then to pursue diplomacy, but it's nothing in comparison to what we're seeing today. Well, I would give you a couple of reasons why suddenly things are moving forward. The first one is the elections in Iran this past June. Contrary to expectations, the population in Iran participated to a very large extent, 70% plus, in these elections. And mindful of how the Iranian government stole the elections last time in 2009, cheated, and then later on repressed the population on the streets for several months, a lot of people, including myself, did not until the last minute expect the population to partake in the elections again. But they did. And they elected the most moderate person that was on the slate. Not a moderate in a general American sense. Perhaps in Texas he would be considered a moderate, but not in most parts of the U.S. But nevertheless, a person who has a very different worldview than most of the foreign policy figures of the Iranian government. This is not to say that this is a person who is not with the regime. He's a regime insider. He's been a critical person within the Islamic Republic's foreign policy for the last 20 years. There's no doubt about that. He is the regime, but he has a very different worldview. This is the same person who, together with the person who currently is the foreign minister, Javad Zarif, in 2001, masterminded outreach to the United States and collaborated with the U.S. in Afghanistan in order to topple the Taliban government, both military, intelligence, support from the Iranian side, and then later on provided crucial political support in order to stabilize Afghanistan and ensure that the country would have a new constitution. According to Jim Dobbins, the representative of President Bush in those conversations, this could not have been done without the help of the Iranians. And they did so because they thought that if they provided this strategic assistance to the United States, the Bush administration would appreciate the value of improved relations with Iran. It could be a building block for a different relationship because they wanted to see a different relationship with the U.S. To their disappointment, the Bush administration put Iran in axis of evil 6 weeks later. 2003, they present the foreign minister, the current foreign minister had a very big hand in this, prepared a comprehensive negotiation proposal that was sent to the U.S. through the Swiss. The Swiss are the caretakers of American interest in Iran in the absence of an American embassy. They sent a proposal over to the U.S., in which they listed all of the key American concerns and created a three-step roadmap on how these things could be achieved. And in the context of those negotiations, the Iranians would have agreed to open up the nuclear program for full transparency, help stabilize Iraq in order to make sure that the government there would not be a sectarian government, collaborate against all terrorist groups, above all Al-Qaeda. Moreover, and perhaps most surprisingly, turn Hezbollah in Lebanon into a mere political organization and put pressure on Hamas and Islamic Jihad to cease violence against Israel. Even agreeing to the Saudi peace plan, the idea that Iran would, together with the rest of the Muslim world, would recognize Israel in return for an Israeli recognition of a Palestinian state. This is the furthest the Iranian government ever have gone towards officially recognizing Israel. In return, the Iranians wanted the lifting of sanctions, a strategic dialogue with the United States, essentially a different relationship with the U.S. The Bush administration did not respond to that proposal, but they did reprimand the Swiss diplomat for having delivered it in the first place. Because at the time, the thinking in Washington was that everything was going the U.S.'s way. Saddam Hussein had just fallen. And whatever could be achieved through negotiations with Iran, even more could be achieved by simply taking out the regime in Iran. And back then, there was a belief that this would be pretty easy because of how things had gone in Afghanistan and in Iraq. 2005, right before the elections in Iran that unfortunately saw the election victory of Ahmadinejad, they made a last attempt and they offer to the Europeans to cap Iran's nuclear program at 3,000 centrifuges. Today, they have 19,000. But the Europeans did not respond favorably, and that was partly because they thought that after the elections they may get a better deal, not expecting that they would actually get Ahmadinejad winning the elections, and everything then, of course, went south. But this is a team that has a different worldview than those who are so skeptical and paranoid about the West. That's not to say that these guys are not skeptical about the West. They are. But they still identify the interest of Iran to be better served by having a better relationship with the United States. Whereas some of the hardliners believe that the interest of Iran would actually be disserved if it moved closer to the West and is better off being as far away from it as possible. So that's factor number one. We have a different team in Iran that is much more amenable towards improving relationship with the United States. Secondly, and this may sound a bit odd, is actually how things developed in Syria. In Syria, the president decided first to go in for military action and then agreed to go to Congress for approval, even though he said that he doesn't believe that he needs it. This gave the American public an opportunity to raise their voices about this. And the voices that they raised shocked Washington because the public was overwhelmingly opposed to the idea of going in militarily in Syria. And it was, even if the numbers were something about 60 to 70% of the public being against it, the ferocity of their sentiments, of those who were against it, compared to the rather almost disinterested support for the war amongst those who actually did support it, became very clear, in which members of Congress were getting 1,000 phone calls against the war for every 3 phone calls they got in favor of it. What that did is that it pushed the Obama administration deep into diplomacy territory. Rather than seeing that diplomacy would have a high domestic political cost, because there would be so much criticism against it, which it will, because it would be so costly in the next elections, which it may, they also realized that the alternative to that, a military confrontation, is actually much, much more unpopular with the American public and will carry a much higher domestic political cost. Immediately after that, you could see how the administration realized that opportunities on diplomacy that did exist were now worthwhile pursuing. And the third factor then is when you take a look at the rest of the region. In a very paradoxical way, Iran in the Middle East right now is the lowest hanging fruit for the United States. Everything else in the Middle East is just going down the drain. But Iran has a small promise of some resolution. Look at Syria. Look at Egypt, Yemen, Iraq, Afghanistan. Look at Saudi Arabia a year from now, when they probably will have a secession crisis. Iran suddenly, after having been one of the toughest issues to address, may actually be one of the easiest ones. And the administration is tactically nimble enough to realize to jump on that. And then, of course, you have the fact that the president realizes that whether he does something on Iran or not, Iran will very much be a part of his legacy. It will be part of his legacy in the sense that during his watch, in spite of all of the sanctions that he's put on Iran that have really crippled the Iranian economy, there's no doubting that, Iran has steadily moved closer towards a nuclear weapons capability. Having about 7,000 or so centrifuges when Obama first came in, they have about 19,000. About 800 to 1,000 kilos of low-enriched uranium, they have more than 10,000 now. They have mastered technology of enriching uranium at 20% and have a stockpile of about 180 kilos of that. All of this taking place during the last 5 years, in spite of all of the pressure that the United States has put on them. That will be the legacy if nothing is done. Or the legacy could be that by striking a diplomatic deal, Iran is prevented, to the extent that is physically possible, from having a nuclear weapons option, while improving relations and finding opportunities to resolve issues in the region in which the United States and Iran both have a lot of influence. And mindful of, again, of how everything else has gone in the region, this can then turn into a very positive element of the legacy of the president. But the most important issue as to why we're actually succeeding right now, in spite of what the French did in the last couple of days, is that for the first time, the two sides have set aside their maximalist objectives and engaged in real diplomacy. And real diplomacy means that there's a give and take, and there's a recognition that the other side has a bottom line. If you demand things that go beyond their bottom line, they're not going to be able to make a deal with you. The other side has to win as well, because if they don't win, if they don't have anything in this deal that makes them satisfied, even if they agree to the deal will not be durable because they will be unsatisfied with it and they will have incentives to cheat, and they will cheat then. If you want to get a real deal, you got to make sure that both sides are happy. So you have to respect the other's bottom line. You have to give them something. And for the first time, the United States and Iran are doing exactly that with each other. The Iranians have recognized that the central concern from the American side is that Iran should be able to provide all of the assurances possible and all of the mechanisms available to make sure that it doesn't build a nuclear weapon. With the right degree of transparency and verification of their program and with the right degrees of limitations, that is achievable. While Iran at the same time retains its bottom line, which is that it will continue to have enrichment below 3.5% on its own soil, which is their bottom line. For the first time now, that is part of the contours of the end game. When Kerry and Zarif met at the UN a couple of weeks ago, they spoke about the parameters of the end game. That was the first time from the Western end that there was an agreement to even discuss what the end state of the negotiations should look like. In the past, from the Western perspective, we have refused to engage in that conversation. We believe that that would come at the end, and if we gave away things that we would agree to at the end, we would give away a lot of our leverage. Now there's a realization that there cannot be a step-by-step process. There cannot be a roadmap unless the roadmap has an end, unless it has a defined destination. You're not going to walk into a blind alley having no clue where it can lead, particularly when the trust between the two sides is so minimal. They've now agreed to that, at least from the side of the United States and Iran. Others within the P5, or at least one other state within the P5, may still need some convincing. But that's why you have an opening. And the sad state of all of this is, all of this could have been achieved 8 years ago. Prior to all of these sanctions and everything else that has happened, all of this could have been achieved 8 years ago. These last 8 years have seen the two sides do nothing more than exhaust their pipe dreams, exhaust the fantasy that they can present the other with a fait accompli. The Iranians have learned the hard way that they cannot expect that the United States ever would accept an unfettered Iranian nuclear program with a weapons option attached to it. That's not going to happen. The United States has learned the hard way
that Iran will never give up the idea that it can have enrichment on its own soil. They view it as a sovereign right. No government in Iran will ever be able to sell that at home. And in the last eight, and a lot of people pointed this out already 8 years ago. But we needed to exhaust all of our fantasies before we were willing to deal with reality, it seems like. And we now reach that point. It's not too uncommon, I guess, when it comes to the state of politics in the world today, that this is the way things go. But it is sad, because on the American side, we can say, well, we have all of these sanctions, and that pressured Iranians to do X, Y, and Z. Well, they're doing the same thing that they actually put on the table 8 years ago. And the Iranians can say that they managed to get the U.S. to accept that Iran will have enrichment on its own soil by expanding and escalating their program as much as they have. Yes, but it's come at the cost of their economy being crushed by the sanctions that the U.S. has imposed. Neither side has really gained any leverage, in my view, because we're ending up pretty much where we started after all of this. But having said all of this, it's also important to realize that even though these breakthroughs have been made, even though realism is now much more defining what is taking place in the negotiations, and even though we got really, really close to a deal 2 days ago, it does not mean that it's a done deal. There's still a tremendous amount of obstacles left. One obstacle on the American side is that the U.S. Senate and the U.S. Congress in, as a whole only has one tool to play with, and that is to impose sanctions. And next week, or actually this week, there's a likelihood that in the National Defense Authorization Act, there will be an additional sanctions imposed on the Iranians in the Senate and voted on. And if you have sanctions imposed on the Iranians in the middle of the negotiations, it will either break down the talks, or it will cause the Iranians to think that they also have to do something really provocative in order to retaliate. And then the question is how we will react when they do something provocative. There's a real concern, I have to say, because if the signal is sent to Rouhani that you adopting a completely different posture from the Ahmadinejad government, much more moderate and pragmatic, and the response from the American side is that we impose more sanctions on you, then he will likely not be able to continue on that path for long, because he will have been proven wrong, and the conservatives in Iran will once again gain momentum and be able to run the foreign policy that they used to run during the Ahmadinejad government. And that will make everyone a loser. The other danger that exists, which is of course that something similar could happen on the Iranian side, but so far we haven't seen that. But the other thing is that the expectations of what a deal should look like in order for it to be acceptable, if it continues to be unrealistic, if we continue to believe that some of those fantasies can be achieved. When I read some of the things that are being written in the media by those who are opposed to the negotiations, and they're saying, well, the only good deal is if X, Y, and Z is achieved. No enrichment in Iran. The Iranians have to give up their entire stockpile, X, Y, and Z. When you set standards that are unachievable, you are ensuring the failure of diplomacy. And you're not dumb enough not to know that. These are elements that are deliberately trying to make sure that it won't happen, that diplomacy will fail, or at a minimum, making it look as if Obama signing this deal will make him look like a sucker, and that it will carry a much, much bigger political cost for him at home. And mindful of the sensitivity of this administration when it comes to issues like this, it is not necessarily a bad strategy if your objective is to make sure that diplomacy doesn't succeed. In fact, the way Congress has been pressing and saying that they will impose more sanctions on Iran within 2 weeks or so, rather than putting pressure on the Iranians, I think he actually put pressure on the Obama administration. So instead of thinking that they had from now till December to strike a deal with the Iranians, in the last weekend, they thought that they only had that weekend to be able to get it done, because they needed to get something done to go back to Washington this week and say to Senate, don't pose any more sanctions, we got a deal. Instead of pressuring the Iranians, the pressure actually ended up coming onto the American side in a very counterproductive way. But what happened in Geneva is also an interesting tale of how unexpectedly things can go wrong. During the first day, talks were going well. It was going so well, so Catherine Ashton called John Kerry and told him that he's needed now because they're reaching a very interesting and final phase, and they may actually have an agreement, and it would be important for the American Secretary of State to be there. And all along, there was an agreement that once they reached that point, mindful of the fact that the Iranian foreign minister is present, protocol would call for it to have John Kerry there as well. He comes in. The negotiations proceed even further. It goes really well. He comes in, of course, after having a very, very bad meeting with Bibi Netanyahu in Israel. So bad that they skipped the media press conference afterwards. They didn't want to do anything that could bring the disagreements between them out there too visibly in public. While in Geneva and making progress, out of the blue, the French foreign minister calls Catherine Ashton and demands that he be present at the talks as well. Somewhat surprised, she agrees, and then she also has to call in the other foreign ministers because you can't have a situation in which the Iranian foreign minister is there, the American foreign minister is there, Catherine Ashton is representing the EU, but then you also have the French one. So you have to call in the German and the Brits, and then, of course, the Russian and the Chinese. Everyone has to get there. So those of us who are observing this mistakenly thought that this is all amazingly good news, that they have a deal, and now they're just kind of delaying it because everyone has to be able to get the chance to show up in Geneva for the photo op. What we didn't know was that the French foreign minister came in and essentially broke a word, a promise that the French had given to the US, which is that they would go along with the deal, even though in principle, the French are more hawkish on some of the key elements of this. And they always have been, and everyone has known that. Instead, the French foreign minister comes in, overrides the French negotiator, and starts throwing in new elements, new demands, maximalist demands, that the Iranians could not agree to. They tried really, really hard. They were up till 2 a.m. in the morning of the fourth day of negotiations, even though this was only supposed to go on for 2 days. And at the end, they couldn't come to an agreement. The French were standing very firmly on their position. And then the French broke protocol. Instead of letting Catherine Ashton and the Iranian foreign minister hold their press conferences before anyone else, the French foreign minister immediately went out there, spoke to the media, gave away details of the negotiations, which all of them had agreed upon should be kept very tightly in order to make sure that the talks could succeed, and left everyone in the room quite livid, according to one person that I spoke to who was there, and very upset with the way that the French were handling this. So definitely giving the impression that this was not a tactic aimed at improving the deal, but rather making sure that there wouldn't be a deal. And the question then now is, after this being done, it's a bit sad because after 34 years, the US and Iran actually had an agreement. They were doing well. They were ready to sign. But they didn't expect that this would come in from the French side. And I don't think it's entirely clear why the French did this. There's a lot of speculation in the media. Various reasons, everything from certain closeness that currently exists or is firming up between the French, the Saudis, and the Israelis, who all are skeptical, if not outright opposed to the idea of a deal, to economic reasons and other things. I don't know enough about that issue to be able to speculate intelligently about it. But one thing is clear. Diplomacy has never come this far. And we've never been this close towards resolving this issue. And I think it should be very, very clear what this issue, what this deal, prior to the French intervention, would have achieved. It would achieve something that we have not achieved in the last 8 years. The Iranian nuclear program would have been frozen. Key aspects of it would have been frozen, would not be making any progress for 6 months, during which there would be additional negotiations in which the final stage, the final agreement, would have been negotiated and agreed upon. This means that, as we've seen in the last 8 years, in which both sides have constantly escalated added more centrifuges, we've added more sanctions, for the first time we would be able to put a pause on this escalation train. This would add time. It would enable the negotiators to negotiate without the pressure of knowing that for every minute, the Iranians are actually inching closer to a breakout capability. It would also have reinstated trust into the process, which would then make it easier to actually find a final agreement. And the final agreement would be one in which the Iranians would have to accept, and they've already indicated that they would, the additional protocol to the non-proliferation treaty. I'm sure many people in this room knows what that is. Let me just briefly explain that the additional protocol is the most powerful instrument we have for inspecting, verifying, and creating transparency into the nuclear program of various countries. As an example, right now, with the degree of inspections that we have right now in Natanz and other places in Iran, if the Iranians were to cheat and try to build a bomb, they would need between 6 to 12 months to succeed, depending on various estimations. But the IAEA would catch them between 30 and 90 days into that process, which would give the international community quite a bit of time to be able to intervene. If the additional protocol is implemented and ratified by the Iranian government as part of a larger deal, the IAEA would catch them within 24 hours. And that is what provides the world the best possible guarantee that they're not cheating, that they're not building a nuclear weapon. Moreover, the additional protocol would provide the opportunity for the IAEA to inspect undeclared sites, meaning they can go anywhere in the country, and confirm that they're not having a secret nuclear program. The way it currently stands is that the IAEA can only inspect sites that are declared by the signatory of the NPT. So you can imagine, under no circumstance could any agreement be found that would be satisfactory without the additional protocol being signed. Even if the United States were to take military action, we would never know if the military action had been successful or not had we not had the verification process in place. Nor would we be able to know that the Iranians have not restarted their program had we not had the additional protocol in place. The United States has never been this close to achieving that. Now, the negotiators will meet again. I want to try to end this a little bit on a positive note. The negotiators will meet again on November 20th to 22nd. The fact that they decided to put it that close, hopefully, is an indication that they believe that it is achievable, that they can come to some sort of agreement. There's some speculation that if the French want to increase the demands of what has to happen in the first phase, that's not necessarily a bad thing. The only problem is it's going to require an equal increase on what the West is offering Iran in return. So the Iranians are likely going to come back and say, sure, you want all of these things as well? Then these other sanctions need to be lifted. What the Obama administration had done was to come to an agreement that, in essence, reduced the sanctions minimally. But if you want to increase the demands, then you probably have to increase the number of sanctions that are relieved as well. Paradoxically, that is the thing that the opponents of the deal are most opposed to. They're fearing that if more sanctions are lifted, the entire sanctions regime will fall apart as a whole. Well, you increase the demands, that's going to be the logical conclusion. Because the Iranians are not as desperate as I think some in Washington may think. Their economy is in a very, very bad shape. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But there is something that they have that I think we should not be too naive about, which is they have managed in the course of the last 2.5 months to do a very effective charm offensive, shown themselves to be very reasonable, and if there is a failure of a deal, it's not going to be terribly difficult for them to shift the blame of that to France, to the US Congress, and to the United States. In fact, the US Congress would be very easy to blame, mindful of the fact that they took the United States to a deadlock just a couple of weeks ago, almost got the entire US economy to a default. it doesn't have a particularly high rating inside of the country or internationally right now. It is not a beacon of reasonableness in anyone's book. So the Iranian ability to be able to shift the blame to the US is not going to be terribly challenging. Under those circumstances, the Iranians will likely be able to get a couple of countries to start peeling off the sanctions regime. But with one big difference: without the Iranians giving any concessions. Whereas if you strike the deal that the Obama administration negotiated, yes, some sanctions would be lifted, and then towards the end of it, a lot of sanctions would be lifted. But for that, we would get real concessions from the Iranians. That's the big difference. That's what's at stake. In the next couple of days, we will find out. Again, my big worry for this week is, if more sanctions are imposed, if we do something that is provocative and unconstructive, unfortunately, the game, the laws of diplomacy means that if one side is stupid, then the other one feels obliged to be stupid as well. And then we'll see where all of this ends. Thank you so much.
Okay, who's out there collecting questions? All right, good. All right, while we're waiting for the questions to come in, I'll start with one of my own. Why do you think, when everyone seems to know the French were the problem in Geneva, as you just said, Kerry in today's New York Times is blaming the Iranians?
There's a couple of reasons. I wouldn't go as far as blaming the Iranians. What actually happened at the end, in a way, what he's saying is technically correct. What happened is that the French came in with new demands, knowing very well that the Iranians could not agree to it. And then the Iranians had to say, well, we can't agree to it, so we have to take it back to Tehran. And that way, you can say technically the Iranians did not say yes. And as a result, the Iranians nixed the deal. Technically correct, in reality, of course, not correct, because there was a deal before the French changed the terms of it. I think from the administration's perspective, they don't want to be on the come across as if they're on the side of Iran against Israel and France. I don't think that would be the right optics for them. But at the same time, I personally think it's a mistake for them not to defend the deal that they had. They had a good deal. It was the best deal that we could have achieved. Hopefully it can still be salvaged. I think they should defend it instead of passing the blame. If they didn't want to go hard out against the French, and they have the option of not doing so, they could at least been silent on it rather than feeling forced to pass blame to the side that they know actually didn't cause the problem this time around.
Okay, here's a question that relates to, you know, you've talked about the possibility that Congress can ruin things in terms of a deal. To what extent can or would internal Iranian opponents, for example, the Revolutionary Guards, be successful in breaking any deal that Rouhani comes up with?
One of the very interesting things that are happening right now is that we've not seen the Iranian government be as disciplined as they are right now when it comes to making sure that they keep their own hardliners, their own very, very unconstructive elements in check. It's really unprecedented to see them this disciplined, because in the past, one of the main problems, one of the first things that used to happen is not that Congress did something, but that some of the hardliners on the Iranian side undermined it. And it was very easy for them to undermine it. All they needed to do was to say a couple of statements about Israel or something of that kind that would be so provocative, that would be so upsetting, that it would ruin whatever atmosphere that had been created. This time around, as a result of the elections, they're kept on the defensive. In the middle of the negotiations, Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, tweeted that he supports the negotiators of his delegation, which was very interesting. At a moment where people were starting to get nervous, he probably felt the need of pushing back the hardliners once more and just keeping them in check. And it's interesting that he chose to do so through a tweet. But that's the reality of today's diplomacy. But this, I fear, is not a sustainable position. If you have this scenario continue, in which there is a different posture from the Iranian side, The U.S. is responding positively as well, yet there isn't a deal, and Congress does something stupid, or France does something unhelpful. At some point, he's not going to be able to rein in the conservatives, and they're going to respond. And this extremely unique, potentially last best chance for a peaceful deal will be falling out of our hands.
Okay, this goes back to the French as well, the French trying to block the deal. Could the United States just ignore the French and unilaterally reach an agreement with Iran?
I fear that's not possible for several different reasons. Even if an interim deal technically could be achieved, at the end of the day, to make sure that this whole deal is resolved, you would need to have a UN Security Council resolution. And for that, the French have a veto. And mindful of the difficulties that have existed between the United States and France in recent weeks and days, not just this, I'm not so sure to what extent the U.S. could strong-arm the French not to. In fact, from the U.S. perspective, I think we weren't concerned because the French had given us a promise that they wouldn't do this. And yet they did. Perhaps this was a tit-for-tat for Syria, in which the French were the only ones that were with the president. Even the Brits were not on the side of the president in favor of military intervention in Syria because of the vote of their parliament. But the French were. According to French press reports, the French jets were on the tarmac, warm engines, ready to fly. Last minute, they get a call from the president saying, he's changed his mind. That left the French out there, alone, quite isolated, and it deeply upset them. Perhaps them breaking their words on this is a tit for tat. Again, we don't know enough yet. But I don't think it is as simple as to think that it can that they can be completely ignored.
Okay, we've got a number of questions asking about Israel's role in preventing a deal. So I'll sort of read them off, and then you can answer them all together. First, why is Israel so distrustful of any agreement? And a related question, why do you think Israel's Netanyahu is so over the top about Iran's nuclear development when they have 200 or 300 nuclear weapons of their own? Is there something more there? And finally, do you think Israel's ability to lobby Congress means that they can scuttle this deal?
I think from the Israeli perspective, this is not about not trusting the deal. What this is about is that if there is a deal, it will dramatically change the political landscape in the region. I think Netanyahu knows very well this deal actually is not a bad deal at all. It's the best possible deal, and it's actually good for Israel in the long run as well. But Netanyahu has his own political circumstances. He has no incentives to come out and say that this was a good deal, or to even come out and say that he's not opposing it. He has a constituency for which he has created a certain idea of what Israel needs to do, and he needs to stick to that line until the very last moment, and then afterwards be able to say, I did everything I could to stop this. Everything I could. Unfortunately, it didn't work, but I did everything. I never gave up. If he gives up even a second before the deal is a complete finished deal, then he has let down that constituency. So his position, in my view, is not surprising, that he would never come out in favor of it. Now, why, from the Israeli perspective, would nevertheless this be a deal that folks around Netanyahu would find problematic? This is not so much about the idea that this would leave the Iranians with a nuclear weapon or anything of that kind. Not to say that Israel doesn't have legitimate concerns about these issues, but the core concerns are these. The fear is that if the Iranians have the nuclear capability, even if they don't have a weapons option, that this will be sufficient to shift the balance of power in the region away from Israel and to Iran's benefit. But most importantly is the fact that if the United States and Iran strike a deal and resolve the nuclear issue a very big portion of U.S.-Iran tensions will have been eliminated. Doesn't mean that the U.S. and Iran would end up becoming best of friends or partners. But it means that a lot of their tensions would be gone. And then the Israelis asked themselves the question, if you have this reduction of U.S.-Iran tensions, will that be followed by a proportionate reduction of Iranian-Israeli tensions? And the folks around Netanyahu conclude that no, that will not be the case. And as a result, Israel will be left in the region still facing a hostile Iran, while the U.S. has resolved its issues and moves on to all of the other global problems that the U.S. has to deal with. And the U.S. is no longer there automatically on the side of Israel in order to be able to balance or challenge what the Iranians are doing. This is their calculation. I think their calculation is fundamentally erroneous. I think the Iranians understand very clearly, if they want to have a durable deal with the United States, they cannot have a durable deal with the United States unless they, not as a formal part of the negotiation, but as a reality of a deal, shift their position on Israel, soften it significantly. In fact, the Iranian posture on Israel has already softened quite a lot since Ahmadinejad left office. And this will be enhanced even further if there is a deal, because suddenly the Iranians have something to lose if they continue with a radical rhetoric against Israel. Right now they don't. They have no deal. They have no trade. They have no interaction with the United States. What could they possibly lose? They're not losing anything. There's not a single Starbucks coffee in any corner in Tehran. There's nothing we can pull out. We have no leverage. But they know very well, and this is part of the reason why hardliners in Iran are against the rapprochement with the United States, because they believe that it eventually will force Iran to shift its position on a lot of issues. But folks around Netanyahu don't see it this way. And even if they did, I think political realities are such that they wouldn't shift their positions anyways. Their influence in Congress will be seen this week as well. They're sending several ministers to lobby Congress directly this week against the deal. And this is, again, the big concern. When you were that close to a deal, you don't want to delay it for 10 days, because that means that you give 10 days to those who don't want the deal to do everything they can to sabotage it further.
Okay, this is kind of the same question, but it's asking about it from the point of view of Saudi Arabia. If Iran were to become the new, the U.S.'s new best friend in the Persian Gulf, what happens between Saudi Arabia and the United States? And a related but broader question, what would be the impact on Sunni nations, the Sunni Arab world, from an Iran deal with the United States?
Thank you. In my second book, Single Roll of the Dice, I interviewed the Saudis about this issue and try to understand their perspective. And if I started off by saying that at the end of the day, I think this is a good deal for Israel as well, because it will soften Iran's position vis-a-vis Israel and actually will improve Israel's security, I cannot say the same thing for the Saudis. The Saudis have something to be worried about. Let me put it that way. And it's for a very simple reason. It's not because the United States and Iran are going to end up being partners. I actually don't find that very likely in the short term, for two very obvious reasons. The Iranians are not at this point interested in being partners with the United States. Improving relations, yes. In fact, Rouhani only has a mandate to fix the nuclear issue. If you listen to what he said in his inaugural, in his UN address, it was not at all as positive as a lot of people had hoped for. And I think it was because he had to play to the conservative audience in Tehran. He said that he believes that the differences, that a mechanism can be created to manage the differences between the United States and Iran. He didn't talk about becoming friends, becoming partners, only about managing the differences. That's how far the hardliners in Iran are willing to go at this stage. Now, after there is a deal, perhaps other opportunities will emerge. But that's important to understand.
Secondly, from the U.S. side, I don't think there's any interest in turning a partnership with the Islamic Republic of Iran, with this specific regime in Iran, mindful of their rhetoric, their human rights record, and many other things. The Saudis are very fearful because they know that the very fundamentals that created the relationship that has existed for the last 60 or so years between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is crumbling. Everything from the dependence on oil to the U.S.'s guarantee of some of these regimes, which from the Saudi perspective, the U.S. already violated the second Obama did not stand firm behind Mubarak until the last moment. From the Saudi perspective, that was a betrayal of this agreement. From the American perspective, it was an adjustment to the realities of a new era in which the Arab populations were not going to indefinitely live with the type of repressive autocratic regimes that they've been living with for the last 60 years, and the U.S. was not going to be on the side of those autocratic regimes. Iran is a big factor in this because from the Saudi perspective, if the U.S. strikes a deal with Iran, and it's any deal, it doesn't matter what was in that deal, it doesn't matter if the French threw in one new element or no new elements, any deal from the Saudi perspective essentially is a vindication, is a verification that the U.S. is going for a new formula for the region. Everything from not fully leaving the region, but not at all having the same footprints that it does have right now, to what are the countries that it will rely on in the region for the security. All of these things that then amass into the Saudi nightmare. So for the Saudis, and of course, because at the end of the day, if there is a deal, there will not be a war. And if you're sitting in Saudi Arabia, you want the United States to attack Iran militarily. Once there is a deal, whichever deal it is, the risk of war would essentially have been eliminated as long as that deal is still valid. And that's what the Saudis are fearing.
Okay, this gets back to your the amount of time you spent in Washington and the contacts you have there. And this is about Obama. Do you think President Obama will try and will he be able to prevent Republican congressmen from putting additional sanctions on Iran this week?
I personally think it's absolutely possible. I don't understand entirely, however, how it's going to be possible using the strategy that the administration is using. I find the strategy at times to be somewhat incomprehensible. I'm not seeing the administration defending what they're doing in the matter that they should. I'm not seeing the administration proactively talking to Congress about these issues. I've spoken to folks in the Senate who said that if they had just come to us 2 weeks earlier, we would have been open. But after having put everything together and gone so deep into the process and they come last minute, it's too late. And I think this has been part of the administration's calculation, erroneous, in which they constantly felt that a public conversation about diplomacy with Iran carried too high of a domestic political cost. So instead of actually preparing the ground, conditioning Washington for the type of a deal that they're likely going to strike, setting the bar for success where they wanted it to be, rather than having the opponents of a deal set the bar where the administration didn't want it to be, the administration has essentially tried to sneak up on Congress and present it with a fait accompli. And that's not possible with a Congress that takes tremendous joy and happiness out of making the life of the president miserable. So, would it have been possible? Absolutely. I think it definitely would have been possible. In fact, look at how Congress behaved on the Syria debate again. If we want to talk about powerful lobbies in Washington, I think it was quite clear that whatever lobbies are out there and whatever power they have, it's to a large extent because of the absence of the American public. When the American public is present, engaged, they actually overrun not only the president, They overran the defense industry. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee publicly, before they started lobbying, announced that they're going to lobby for this, and they did not manage to win a single member of Congress to their side. So if you utilize the energy and sentiment that exists in the public right now, because I don't think, if the American public is against this relatively small military engagement with Syria, rest assured they're going to be against a war with Iran that is going to be bigger than Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria combined. If you utilize these sources and these energies in the public, you can definitely win in Congress. But you can't do it if you almost refuse to use it.
We're winding down. We're a little bit over, but we've got time for another couple of questions. And this one is sort of related to the last one. Do you think if these talks work out, do you think we should give credit to Secretary of State Kerry or to President Obama?
Look, I just want to make sure that there's a deal. I don't care who gets credit. Look, at the end, I want to make sure that we understand what the stakes are here. Because if this deal is not struck, and if we don't prevent Iran from getting closer to a weapons capability, at some point, whether during this presidency or the next presidency, there's going to be a very, very serious conversation about military confrontation. That's what this is about. Those are the stakes. It may sound very far-fetched right now because of how things are moving along right now and diplomacy is taking place, etc. But that is the bottom line. Remember, this president may be very disinclined to use military force. We have no idea what the next president is going to look like. And particularly if the Iranians move and they're really on the verge of having a nuclear weapon, the conversation in this country is going to change. And the very sentiments of the public against the military confrontation can also change. This is what is at stake right now. So whether the president gets the credit or Kerry, I don't have an opinion on.
Okay. All right. Here are two offbeat questions that we'll end with. And they're unrelated, and I'll ask them both at the same time, because the first one you may dismiss in 30 seconds, but it's an interesting question. Does Reza Pahlavi, and I guess that's the son of the Shah, have a political future in Iran at some point? And the other question is, can you talk about what the man in the street in Tehran thinks about the United States?
I think we're kind of lucky in the sense that Iran is one of the few countries in the Middle East right now in which the population still tends to have a relatively positive view of the United States. That's not to say that they are big fans of U.S. foreign policy. In fact, I think they're overwhelmingly not. But they separate U.S. foreign policy from America because they do that with themselves. They love their country, but they're not big fans of their own foreign policy. So they do the same thing for the United States. They appreciate and admire what America has achieved, American values, the American people. There's a million Iranian Americans in this country. They all have tons of relatives in Iran. There's not a single person in Iran who doesn't have a relative in this country. They know how tremendously successful and good America has been to the Iranian American community. So there's a lot of affinity. I fear that some of that affinity has been eroded in the last 3 years. Because the way the sanctions have hit ordinary people in Iran is absolutely devastating. Sanctions have cut the currency of the Iranian, has cut the value of the Iranian currency with about 50%. Oil income is less than 60% now. People are dying in the hospitals because there's medicines that they cannot buy because of sanctions. Not because the medicines are sanctioned, because the U.S. has not sanctioned medicine, but because the U.S. has sanctioned any bank doing any dealings with Iran. So they're permitted to buy the medicine, but there's no bank that is willing to handle the transaction. So relatively simple diseases has actually led to situation in which people are dying in the hospitals, and that's a direct result of the sanctions. In the long run, you can't have that and expect people to retain a positive view. And we're lucky. We have a strategic asset in Iran, which is the hearts and minds of the population there, soft power. We hardly have that anywhere else in the Middle East, particularly not with the countries whose governments we're on good terms with, paradoxically. So we should be very careful not to lose it, mindful of the fact that I think we do know how difficult it is to build it It's tremendously difficult to build it. So where we have it, we should be cautious and make sure that we don't easily lose it. In regards to Reza Pahlavi, I'm sure in the future Iran with a different regime, if he wants to be part of it, I think there would be a lot of people who would be very curious to know what his views are, etc. But whether he would have a chance or not, or to be frank with you, whether he would want to engage in what is, at the end of the day, going to be a very competitive and messy political process, I don't know. It's very comfortable life in Maryland.
Terrific. That's a good way to end it. And here, before you step down, this has been fascinating, Treat. It's been really great, and especially coming at this particular time. So we're happy to award you with the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations mug, which you may well want to take to the Stephen Colbert Show. Who knows?
Thank you. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Really
Can I put it back in here?
Yeah. Thank you.